The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you the best for the new year.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
On the world stage, things are quite fraught and charged up. And humanity seems to be collectively drowning in an ocean of chronic planetary traumatic stress. So we might ask, what life raft might I reach for? Is it one that will carry me on a continued pursuit of consumerism and chasing after the next shiny thing? Or might I choose to climb aboard the raft of substantial spiritual support that will reshape my choices in a more life-supporting way of being? The good news is that we have access to the timeless and practical wisdom of two American philosophical treasures, Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, who have profound messages of relevance to impart that address the problems we face today. And that is what we'll be exploring with our guest, Mark Matusik. Mark Matusik is a teacher, spiritual seeker, and award-winning author of many books. He leads transformative workshops, intensive and guided writing sessions that mentor participants to reach their artistic and personal goals by using writing as a tool for inside innovation and clarity of purpose. He's the founder of the Seekers Forum, an online community for self-inquiry. His many books include Writing to Awaken, A Journey of Truth, Transformation, and Self-Discovery, and Lessons from an American Stoic, How Emerson Can Change Your Life. Join us for the next hour as we explore the radical and relevant philosophy of Ralph Waldo Emerson and why his transformational wisdom is exactly the medicine we need today with our guest, Mark Matusik. I'm speaking with Mark from his home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Justine. It's great to see you again.
Oh, it's marvelous to see you once more. I want to go back. You took one book with you early on many years ago when you traveled to India. And that book was The Portable Emerson, right? Why that book? What made you choose that book?
From the time I discovered Emerson when I was a grad student at UCLA, he became a lifeline for me to transcendental cosmic vision and connection. I was an agnostic, raised as an atheist. I had no spiritual background. But when I started reading Emerson, sort of accidentally, as a research assistant for someone writing a book about him, I touched on something that I felt I already knew. When Emerson wrote about the vastness, the infinitude of the private man, I knew what he was talking about. And he became for me a touchstone for that kind of awareness. And so he was with me always. And when I went to India, I was under duress. I had just gotten a bad diagnosis. I didn't think I was going to be around that long. And he was always there to kind of talk me off the ledge on a bad day. I could read a page of Emerson and come back to myself, come back to a sense of possibility that is easily shrunk in the world, not only because of the dangers of the world that we all know, but I was also in crisis. So Emerson for me became a very potent reminder of another way of seeing.
He has a very interesting history. I'd love for you to share a bit about the time that he lived in. What was going on in the world at that point? Where did he live? What was his family configuration? So give us a little thumbnail of the bowl that he was living in at the time.
Sure. Well, Emerson was born in 1803. He was the middle child. He had four brothers who were all outstanding and intelligent and outgoing. And Emerson himself was a quite antisocial, awkward, chubby, timid, sickly boy. So he was the Emerson child of whom nothing much was expected. And his father died when he was 9 years old, which left the family in kind of genteel poverty. His mom started taking in boarders. It was hand to mouth. So he grew up with a sense of real precariousness in his world. He was surrounded by death from an early age. Two of his brothers then died of tuberculosis. So this was a dangerous and difficult time to be alive. So that was his family background. And the New England that he was born into, he was born in Boston, and he eventually moved to Concord, Massachusetts, was in a time of real ferment and danger. Slavery was a huge issue. Abolition was on the rise. Emerson was in the crosshairs. He was a seventh generation minister. So he had inherited a very prestigious job. Eventually, when he got out of college, he did become a minister for a time. And he was in the crosshairs of this very intense dialogue around things like abolition and slavery, the rights of man, materialism versus spirituality. That was a huge thing in his time. He saw what was happening in this young, kind of callow, wealthy country and what would happen if we lost track of our spiritual roots. And that was a real concern for him as a minister. And then he lost his faith. After his wife died, he went through a major crisis of faith. He didn't feel like he could administer the sacraments anymore in good faith. So he left the church and he became a speaker on the Lyceum circuit and spent the next 50 years traveling the country, talking to people without a collar on, so that he was literally uncollared. You know, he was free to speak his mind and say what he wanted. And he eventually became the conscience of his generation. He was the guy who came out against the Fugitive Slave Act. He was very vocal in terms of education and history, scholarship, the need for cultivating what he called self-reliance. He was the spiritual godfather of our country during its most violent history, period in history. And so he was someone I thought had a lot to say to the moment that we're living in now.
There was a really fascinating story about how he was invited back to Harvard at some point to speak to the young student theologians.
Sure. Well, he was invited, as you were saying, to address the Harvard Divinity School. And instead of talking about the wonders of the church and the importance of obeying authority, he came in and started talking to these kids about leaving school, not needing books, go into the woods. You don't need an intermediary to connect to God, everything that they were not taught in school. It was absolutely sacrilegious. And in fact, it was so blasphemous that he was evicted, kicked off the Harvard campus for 30 years. He wasn't allowed to come back to the Harvard campus. People were so shocked he was a real pagan in his time. He was a radical.
That's what's so amazing to me. And also you mentioned at the time there was two schools of thought. There was materialism, you know, that was rampant and came out of Europe in the age of enlightenment and rationality and all of that. And then there was this other thing that was happening that he held to. And he also held to what is called self-reliance. And when we think of that, we might think, oh, this means we stand as an individual. Well, what did he mean when he talked about self-reliance?
This is the biggest misunderstanding about Emerson's teaching, because self-reliance is his best known essay. What he meant by self-reliance was self-trust, not self-sufficiency. He wasn't talking about isolationism or arrogance or patriarchy or rugged individualism. He was talking about self-trust. That was his theme, you know, throughout all of his work, was listening to what he called the whisper only you can hear, you know, that still small voice within. That's what self-reliance is about. He said self-reliance is reliance on God. And what he meant by God wasn't a patriarchal traditional God. It was reliance on the divine intelligence that we share. He said there's nothing so weak as an egotist. You know, the way people think of self-reliance is as egotism. There's nothing so weak as an egotist. He was as contrary to egotism as it's possible to be. But unfortunately, people get hung up on that terminology, and they confuse him. And so that's how his work has been co-opted very often by people like Ayn Rand or Ronald Reagan or people who wanted to talk about this kind of John Wayne machismo. That is not what Emerson was about.
And when you talk about listening to the voice inside and God within, there's something that you have written. And I just want to compliment you. You guide us through this book. You divide it up into different lessons, 12 lessons. And you have done such extensive research, not just on his writings, but his talks and all of that. And then you bring in Thoreau and other, his neighbors were Herman Melville and Walt Whitman and Margaret Fuller and others. I mean, it's just an amazing collection of people. I loved what you wrote about the God within. And I just want to read it because it was so lovely. You write, "Every molecule in nature houses the soul in miniature. The tiniest unit of life contained God, and this spiritual consciousness pervades every cell. It is our biological predisposition toward awakening to our true nature." And I just love that because you talk about, and he talked about, divinity is close. It's in proximity to our very being. The cells of our very body is what he's talking about.
Right. And we are nothing but God. The reason he talks about going into nature, for example, is to remind us that we are nature. And for Emerson, nature was a manifestation of God on earth, just as we are. There was absolutely no separation.
No,
the divine intelligence is what's flowing through our veins. It's what's making the heart beat. That's divine intelligence. So there's really no separation. He was a true pantheist in that sense. He was a transcendentalist. He genuinely saw non-duality as the bottom line.
I'm here with Mark Matusik, and he is the author of Lessons from an American Stoic, How Emerson Can Change Your Life. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Mark Matusik. He is the author of Lessons from an American Stoic, How Emerson Can Change Your Life. And we're talking about Ralph Waldo Emerson. And in the book, you talk about when he first met Henry David Thoreau, 8 years his junior, one of the first questions he asked him is, do you keep a journal? And so tell me, why is journal writing important to him? Because I know that's also important to you, Mark.
It is. Journal keeping for Emerson was how we practice self-inquiry and how we move toward a self-reliance is through self-investigation. And journaling was his favorite way of doing it. He called his journal The Wide World. And it got him through an isolated, unhappy, confusing, traumatizing childhood. And he kept keeping a journal throughout his life. As I have, I started when I was a very young kid. I started when I was 8 or 9 years old, and I've been keeping a journal ever since. And what it has taught me and what it taught Emerson is that putting your thoughts and feelings into language has a uniquely transformative and healing power. That when we take what's inside us, the formless and a maelstrom of the mind stream, and put it down on paper, it gives us insight. When we practice the witness awareness, that's where the insight comes in. You see, gosh, is that what I believe? Is that the story I'm telling myself? We learn so much by putting our experience into words. It's how we stay connected to this whisper that only we can hear. And this is something that Emerson got from the Stoics, the original Stoics, Marcus Aurelius and Seneca, all journal keepers. They all used what they called spiritual exercises, mostly through journaling, to move themselves philosophically toward awakening, toward freedom, and toward insight. You know, when we're stuck in our experience and identified fully with it, there's no insight that happens. We need to create a space. And that's, of course, what we do with therapy. We do it with deep dialogue with other people. Sometimes we do it in reflection and prayer, sometimes in meditation. But Emerson recommends journaling. And it's what I understood the best, which is why I make a lot of that in the book.
Well, it just reminds me, it's also a really good way to know our biases, to understand the conditioning with which there's a term that is kind of used throughout the book, and it's called angle of vision. And I love that term. I don't think I've ever seen it quite spoke. I've seen, you know, open our lens of perception or something like that. But angle of vision, talk about that angle of vision and why it's important for us to know from what angle we're looking at life.
It's everything. Emerson said, what is man but his angle of vision? You know, what are we but our perspective? You know, this oculus that we look at the world through. It's what defines our character. You know, how you see is who you are, and who you are is how you see. He has a wonderful quote somewhere that we don't realize that the world is in lives in ruins because we are in shambles within ourselves. You know, we don't understand that the way we see is what's creating our reality. So that's the first step toward self-awareness, whether, you know, it's using Emerson's philosophy, whether it's using standard mindfulness practice, is recognizing that you are not your story. You're the storyteller, not the story. You are the person who has created this perspective that you look through. You're not the perspective itself. And when you get that, there's a little wiggle room for change. And this is something we need today. People are so identified with their opinions. They have no idea that these opinions don't define them and that they're looking through a glass darkly, you know, and seeing shadows that aren't there and missing illuminations that are there. You know, our perspective determines everything. And that's what Emerson called the angle of vision. We have to question that angle of vision.
There's a phrase that I wrote down because I thought it was so striking. He said, people only see what they are prepared to see. The health of the eye seems to demand a horizon. What they are, in the word prepared to see. That has a lot in it, that one word. Can you elaborate on what he was meaning there?
Sure. That's the meaning of implicit bias, you know, is that what we expect to see is what we see. And what we don't expect to see, we often miss. It just goes completely by, you know, by our attention, because we're not prepared for it. You know, that's how we create the world. We create the world with how we see and through our own limitations. And what he says about horizon, if we don't have a sense of possibility, if we don't have a sense of the distance we can travel and the largeness of the world, then it's hard to grow toward it, right? We need a horizon to grow toward. We need to have a sense of breadth and scope to enlarge ourselves. If we don't have that, then we're living at the, you know, like at the bottom of a well, like it says in that, you know, famous Indian story, the little frogs who live at the bottom of the well, and they deny there's anything outside until one frog climbs up and looks and, you know, sees the ocean and goes back, and the others don't believe him because they're not prepared to see what this frog has seen. And Emerson's great gift was giving us this vista, giving us this panorama. You know, you asked me what I got from Emerson to begin with. It was that vision. I had never come across it before. I didn't have a spiritual background. So the sense that there could be this grandeur in the world, and that we had this extraordinary capacity for growth, was news to me. And I needed the horizon of Emerson's work to really set me on my own spiritual path.
Well, I'm thinking, Mark, you know, it's reminding me of something to prepare for a spiritual trip. And I'm thinking of this Seneca quote, which I just love that you brought up in the book. If one does not know to which port one is sailing, no wind is favorable. You have to have your compass set for something, you know, your trip. Yeah. And that goes back to what you were just talking about how we may not have control over what we perceive, what we see, but we have control over how we perceive it. So therefore, that's where we look at our goal. Like if we consider a goal rather than, oh, why am I a victim of this? Oh, life is just terrible. You also talk about the why and the how. And those are two different things. So I'd love for you to talk about the purpose of both asking the question why, and if that's a good question to be asking, or asking the question how.
This is really important on any path of self-knowledge. It's important up to a point to understand how, you know, why things have happened. You know, there's a certain amount of analysis, retrospection, understanding is helpful. But why becomes a never-ending circle of interrogation, and you become like this Ouroboros, you know, that's eating its own tail. You just go around in circles and you don't make progress. It's a much more useful question to ask how. And Emerson was all about taking the next step, not getting stuck in ratiocination, you know, not getting stuck in cogitation, and trying to answer unanswerable questions. I mean, the fact of the matter is we have such a limited powers of knowledge. We know so little about the big picture. Trying to get to ultimate causation is a fool's game. We're not going to get there. What we can do is understand it to the best of our ability and then move into what now? And then move into what do I do with this? What do I do with this knowledge? You know, how do I want to use this situation to move forward in my life? And he's a great proponent of using adversity, in particular, using hard times and doing what the Stoics called turning the obstacle upside down. You know, realizing that the answer is often within the problem itself. And so he's very practical in that way and understands how easy it is to get caught in rumination. And that's where why takes you very often after you've done the, you know, it's kind of the fundamental analysis. Right. Move on to how to live your life.
Well, talking about like adversity and going to, there is a phrase somewhere, let's see, I want to talk about loss. Like we can consider that an adversity. Loss does not stain the soul. And I love that idea. And you actually had an epiphany at some point in your life to understand about the loss of a loving relationship in your life. Can you speak about that, Mark?
Yes, absolutely. I had gone through a terrible breakup, one of the worst in my life. I was really devastated emotionally and flattened. I couldn't seem to pull out of it. Then one day I had this realization. I realized that the pain I was feeling was connected to the story that I had somehow been diminished. I had been stained. I had been handicapped by this. This was going to prevent me from loving in the future. I had this whole narrative connected to this breakup. And I suddenly realized that no one could stop me from loving. Even this person that I had had this terrible relationship with, I could continue to love from a distance. No one could make me shut my heart down. And as soon as I felt that, Justine, I felt liberated. You know, there was still sadness over what happened, but there wasn't the gloom and the sense of diminishment that I had that was the real source of my pain. I realized that I was free to love. No one could tell me, could stop me from loving. And I can't tell you how uplifting that was at a time when I just felt like my heart had been sucked out of my body.
Yeah, and that kind of loss, too, it's not like when we've, let's say, through the death of a loved one or something like that, and we talk about going through grief and then maybe at some point getting over that grief. Maybe that's not what we should do. Maybe there is something else.
Well, there's a wonderful book by Pauline Boss called The Myth of Closure. And this idea that things close down, that emotional wounds close up, like they're neatly sutured and then grief passes and you don't feel it again, is a complete myth. We live with our losses. They become part of who we are. Grief becomes one piece of furniture in the room of our life. It doesn't go anywhere. You learn to live with it. And you also learn what it can teach you. And Emerson was always talking about not being diminished by our losses, and that things that happen in the exterior life, as he called it, don't diminish or don't weaken or limit the spirit. You know, he said the soul refuses limits. Most people who've been through grief know that experience of suddenly, after great grief, something rises. You know, what Emily Dickinson called the thing with feathers. It's somewhere it rises, and you're still there.
And you're still there. I'm here with Mark Matusik, and we're just having this marvelous conversation about life and how to live it. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Mark Matusik, and I want to say something